At this moment, I feel, I don't know, there, I guess I would call this feeling neutral, not bad, not good.
Jamila Lemieux started the day with a shower. In the pre-pandemic world, that's how she started every day. But now that shower gets later in the morning, depending when and if she needs to leave the house.
Other than that, like, I have a ton of stuff to do today. I'm on deadline for a story that's due tomorrow. That's not, I'm not where I should be for a story that's due tomorrow. My daughter's here, but she leaves this evening. I've got a bunch of meetings. It's another Groundhog Day. It's another Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day. Sounds familiar. Jamila lives in Los Angeles. She's a freelance writer and mother of a little girl.
So now class ends at like 1:40. Some days they go until 3. But for the most part, the day is pretty short. And so she wants to play. She wants to talk. She has, things to share with me. And I can't give her my time. So that makes me feel guilty.
So there's considerable mental stress and heartache, not being able to be there fully for the two things that give Jamila's life meaning, her daughter and her work.
It's not just something I do to keep the lights on, like I care about it. So when I'm taken away from that, it's not just taking me away from what I do to make a living. It's something that sustains me and makes me feel good about myself and gives me, purpose. And like, especially as a mother who we have a joint, informal, no courts or anything, no mediation, but like my little one divides her time in half between my house and her dad's house. To have already, like, just the disruption of this limited time that we have together and me not being able to give it all to her really makes me feel awful.
So Jamila, like so many others, maybe even like you, are feeling the burden on her mental health as we mark almost, or we're getting near, 1 year of this pandemic.
The other day, for the first time, I kind of, it was a really bad day. Just everything around me just felt like it was just too much. And like each moment, like when I thought I kind of pulled it together and, I did my affirmations and everything's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Something else happened. And, I was in the car and got a little, bad news. And, I cried a bit and I had a moment and I kind of saw myself going down that familiar path of like, this is so awful. Everything is awful. I'm so unfortunate. And I just had to stop. And I was like, this feels worse than it did before.
That's Jamila Lemieux. She lives in Los Angeles. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And today we're going to talk about collective mental health, because in the past, another president used a global disaster to kickstart mental health treatment in the United States. That was President Truman. Following World War II, he created the National Institute of Mental Health in response to the high need for mental health services among soldiers and civilians. So could this modern-day disaster, the COVID pandemic, be an opportunity for another major expansion of mental health services? Is it needed? That's what we're going to take a look at today. And we're going to start with Dr. Luana Makis. Dr. Makis, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
How would you describe the mental health effects of this pandemic? Is there another pandemic of mental stress right now?
I definitely think we're going to have another pandemic. About a year for many of us felt like a sprint and we are on fight or flight. People are sent home. But as your guest said, a lot of Americans, 56% of Americans are suffering with emotional consequence of this. And as this pandemic goes on, we've really been thrown into a marathon of emotional challenges. And some of us are not runners, and even the runners among us, the finish line continues to change. And the lack of connection and the social isolation has really led to increased depression and anxiety, and we are not out of it. So I definitely need to get ready for what might come.
Mm. Well, Dr. Makis is the president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. She's also associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and director of Community Psychiatry Pride at Massachusetts General Hospital. I'm wondering, you know, people are looking at the increased vaccinations or even the existence of COVID vaccines as maybe a way to say, okay, well, this is marking hopefully the beginning of the end, right? And so things are going to be fine after that. Can you say that the vaccines will also bring improved mental health?
So I think the vaccine is symbolizing hope for many of us that things might change and that it may look better. I don't think it's necessarily going to correlate improvement in mental health immediately. What we know just from research is that when we are faced with fear, with fight, we get in a state of fight or flight. And many of us have been there for a chronic long time in the past year. And so what we see is that perhaps when things get to a little better is when people allow themselves to actually start to feel their emotions, to understand what's actually happening. And at that point, most people might actually need some help. And so I think it's certainly the beginning of hope, but I also seen this clinically with my patients feeling like, and then what are we going to look like? And a lot of uncertainty and fear of this new life that we have no ability to predict what will look like.
You know, isn't that one of the interesting or most difficult challenges of mental health and providing mental health services or getting people to be mentally healthier, right? Because for something like a viral caused disease, we can formulate a vaccine, right? For economic distress, it is possible, although challenging in the United States, all granted, but like we know we need to get people back to work. We need to help them, you know, put food on the table. They're really distinct, discrete things that can be done to make a big difference. Is there something similar in mental health?
You know, if we start thinking about this, not just as mental health, but brain health, and we really rely on neuroscience and think about what we know about the brain and what can actually heal the brain and help the brain function better. And so there are lots of techniques fall under the umbrella of what's known as cognitive behavioral therapy. It's really briefly is the idea of what you say to yourself, your thoughts affect how you feel, your emotions, and then that affects your behavior. So I think about this as thoughts, emotions, and behaviors in the cycle. There are more than 450 randomized controlled trials. So science-driven studies suggesting the CBT is effective. The question that we had before this pandemic is most people don't have access to this. And so even though we know it exists, the question I wrestle with a lot is how do we think about this as skills, not therapy? How do we think about prevention, not intervention today so that we don't get to a point where most people have such a high temperature that we really can't bring it down fast enough?
In preparing for this show, you told our producer that one of your concerns is that there is no quote-unquote vaccine for mental health, right? That we need entirely different sets of tools to improve mental health.
That's exactly right. That we can't just have a vaccine that really, you know, most of us can have it. We really need to think about what somebody needs and tailor to their specific brain. But we certainly can at a public and in a societal level, think about prevention as a sort of a common denominator. For example, lots of studies suggest that being in the present moment, mindfulness, is extremely helpful and can prevent the development of mental illness. So is there ways for us to start thinking more of a emotional vaccine, so to speak, that could help us as a wave of mental challenges that a lot of Americans and globally individuals are facing?
So we're going to talk more about specific things that individuals can do and things that, you know, the nation can and should do to increase access to mental health services due to the pandemic. But Dr. Marquise, I wanted to just sort of ask you, like human to human, a question here. I think there has, given the disparate impact that the pandemic has had on people in the United States, right? I mean, we know that communities of color have been hit particularly hard. And then if you layer upon that the economic impact that has come along with the pandemic, there has been, disparate suffering. I think a lot of people, out of a sense of good intention, are saying, well, you know, it's been a really hard year for me, but at least I have a job. You know, at least I have the roof over my head and I'm not suffering as much as this other people or other folks. Or even folks who've lost their jobs, if they're managed to hold on to their homes, they say, well, at least I have my home, even if I don't have my job. Or I haven't had a loved one who's died. You know, I guess I'm saying that there's this desire to say, there but for the grace of God, right? But I do wonder, mm-hmm. does that do individuals a disservice to themselves? Because, I mean, we all can only live within the relative experience of our own lives.
Yes, Meghna, I think what you're describing is this desire to be okay. And for us to be able to say, you know, what I have, I'm so thankful. And being thankful, certainly having gratitude can help in the moment and it can be protective, allows you to really not catastrophize, not to think about the worst case scenario. I do think you're hitting something slightly different too, which is this idea that perhaps it's a way to avoid even expressing that it is challenging and being able to say, wow, this is really tough, or maybe I need help here. And sometimes when we have very little, it's hard to even do that. I grew up in Brazil in a pretty challenging situation. And this pandemic makes me think a lot about my kids, a single mother. How did she do it and never complained? And I think today we know that, you know, it was a lack of support. And I think people need to know that it's okay to ask for help. And it's also okay to be grateful for what you have and that gratitude can help in the moment.
Wow. Well, we are talking this hour about the increased collective need for mental health services and support that's been brought on by the pandemic. Dr. Maki, stand by for just a minute. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the increased collective need across the country for mental health assistance and services because of all the pain and pressure brought on by the COVID pandemic. And, you know, we want to hear from you. We have been hearing from On Point listeners, and we want to continue to hear from you. So hop over to Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio, and let us know, has your mental health deteriorated over the past year in any way? How do you know? And what help do you think you need? Have you been able to get? How do you hold yourself up, or try to, at least? Again, send us a note at On Point Radio. We're at Twitter and Facebook. We had some listeners who reached out to us over the phone. For example, here's Dominic Medeiros.
Everyone I know is depressed. Everyone I know cannot wait for this virus to just go away. It's really sad not having human interaction. It's definitely taken a toll on everyone. I don't see anyone laughing anymore. I don't see any smiles on anybody's faces. It just seems everybody's drained and just tired of it all. And I don't know. Like I said, I hope this ends soon.
We're joined today by Dr. Luana Maki. She's president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Maki, we're going to hear from another listener in just a second, but can you reflect on what Dominic said? It sounds like a lot for him, a lot of the impact is also seeing everybody else around him looking drained, not laughing, as he says. And that's perhaps redoubled the mental health impact on him. Like, there isn't really any place to escape from a sense that the pandemic is all around us.
Megan, I think Dominic is completely right. You know, even if you leave your house, everybody's wearing a mask. You can't see a smile. You can't really touch that smile. Happy. And so if you are particularly sad and you're looking outside to get some joy, that joy has decreased significantly. And I've heard that from many of my patients, exactly what Dominique is expressing.
Well, let's listen to another On Point listener. This is Tamara, from Massachusetts, saying that part of the strangeness of this past year isn't just in politics. And the pandemic, there are also all those questions about restrictions and really the way that she's had to change and restructure her life.
The isolation has been a constant struggle between a tug of war between depression and anxiety and a constant struggle to try to find ways creative solutions to tamper those emotions down. It's been a very difficult time in so many ways, but the isolation, I've noticed I struggle with changes in my outlook, changes in my sleep pattern, my dreaming, and it's just generally been very uncomfortable.
Dr. Marquise, how common is that, changes in even how people sleep when they're under this kind of prolonged duress?
It's extremely common, Magna. So one of the things that you see a lot is this combination of depression and anxiety that's mixed. It gets in the way of your focusing, it gets in the way you're being productive. And a lot of people then start to report they're laying in bed and they're worrying, their brain is racing, they're trying to figure out how they're going to get through the next day. And so irritability, difficult concentrating, and sleep challenges are the three things that I hear the most as a consequence of anxiety and depression currently.
Okay. So I hope you don't mind. You said a little earlier, your line is occasionally dropping out, but I just wanted to let listeners know. You said a little earlier that you grew up in Brazil. Is that right, Dr. Marquise?
That's correct.
Okay. And so I wanted to just take a second to talk with you about the differing needs or differing cultural approaches, even within the United States amongst different communities, on willingness to seek help, right? Because we were talking about how, maybe people are trying to not catastrophize, but at the same time, it might prevent them from seeking out the kind of help they need. And the reason why is because over the course of the week, I have been thinking about one of my favorite poets. I know this sounds like a non sequitur, but there's a point here. And her name is Rina Espaillat. She's an amazing poet. And she has this poem called Find Work. And I'm just going to read it to you. It's a short one. And in the poem, Rina writes, "My mother's mother widowed very young of her first love and of that love's first fruit, moved through her father's farm, her country tongue and country heart anesthetized and mute with labor. So her kind was taught to do, find work, she would reply to every grief, and her one dictum, whether false or true, told heavy with her passionate belief. Widowed again, with children in her prime, she spoke so little it was hard to bear, so much composure, such a truce with time, spent in the lifelong practice of despair. But I recall her floors, scrubbed white as bone, her dishes, and how painfully they shone." And that poem comes to mind again and again because I just think that it's deeply ingrained in some individuals and perhaps even culturally to not seek out help. I mean, how much is that a factor in the rise of mental distress that you've been seeing?
It's a beautiful poem, and let me start there. And it threw me back on sort of growing up and witness actually exactly what you're talking about. And I think there is a combination of individual and culture. So in the Latinx community in the U.S. and in Brazil, as I grew up, seeking help is a sign of weakness. Seeking help is a sign that you are quote unquote crazy. And so individuals are thought not to seek help despite of their broken heart. And it's similar on, for example, the African-American community that at times, appropriately so, has distrust of the majority of doctors. And so silence or seeking their clergy is the way to seek help. And so I think stigma and mistrust is very much still alive in different communities, and different communities express the stress different. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, that a lot of the patients that I work with who are Latinos say, you know, I have a headache, my stomach, to say I'm anxious and I need some help. And I think it's really important for us. That's why I more and more talk about brain health. Perhaps we can decrease the stigma by reminding ourselves that if you had diabetes, you'd go to your doctor. Your brain's another organ. We need to get you help when it's not working for you.
Well, Dr. Maquis, if you'll just hang on for a second, I want to now bring into the conversation Dr. Kevin Simon. He's a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow at Boston Children's Hospital and a clinical fellow in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School as well. Dr. Simon, welcome to you.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Meghna.
Really glad to have you because, of course, this isn't an issue that's just befalling adults, right? We're all living in this pandemic world, and we wanted to get a sense from someone who focuses on adolescent and pediatric psychiatry of sort of what have you been seeing over the past year?
Yeah, so, you know, I think what I've been seeing is a couple of things. Initially, when we're talking about February, March of last year, you know, schools were kind of closing down for what seemed to be 2 weeks at a time. And parents were kind of on board with that, given the nature of the pandemic. However, as the weeks turned into months, the adolescents, the youth were at their own ends wits, particularly just the idea of like, I want to get outside, I want to be with my friends. And so I've definitely seen patients now at this point who, you know, haven't seen their friends in over a year's time. And one can imagine having just one child or a couple of kids in the home who are being told, you know, you can't go outside, or if you do go outside, you got to wear a mask. Kids classically are trying to figure out who they are for themselves and find their space. And so when you're hampering that, you're going to create tension. And so what I've recognized is a number of families existing in just continuous prolonged tension where kids are having more behavioral outbursts, temper tantrums. And then at the hospital, we've seen an uptick in emergency room visits, particularly for mental health conditions. And so the stress is overwhelming, and it is certainly bleeding into the children. And at this point, a number of the kids that I talk to, you know, they're just kind of fed up. And kids, you know, have a difficult time with like delayed gratification, a lot of difficult times with thinking a couple of years ahead. And so the idea of, oh, you know, six more months for an 8-year-old is particularly challenging. And then the idea of 6 more months for, you know, the high school senior is like, it's not settling at all.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about how kids are finding ways to cope with this? I know that, I mean, you have a story of are we seeing increased substance use amongst kids? Do we know?
Yeah. So, you know, we did see and we're continuing to see increasing uses of substances, whether that's alcohol, vaping, marijuana. And so in the beginning, last summer, there were stories of some of our patients and around the country, because we're asking people to wear masks, kids are wearing masks, wearing a hoodie, going into the store and confiscating, you know, substances. And then the patients that I see, parents are having to essentially turn off their mail, have it delivered to the post office. So that way that's where they get it, because kids were going online and figuring out ways to get substances to their home. So there definitely has been a rise in the use pattern of kids, so much so that even in the clinic that I'm in there, when we look at, you know, a three month period of the summertime compared to 3 month period of summertime in 2019, there's a drastic ramp up of appointments being made, appointments not being canceled. So we're certainly seeing the services are being far more utilized now with regards to both substance use and then particularly for psychiatric care.
Wow. Okay. So, but remind me, Dr. Simon, mental health services were already, you know, not where we needed them to be for adults. The same is true for children and adolescents, right? Even before the pandemic, wasn't there a lack of such services?
Yes. Yeah. So this has been a chronic issue dating decades. So we're talking about specifically child and adolescent services, whether that's psychiatrists, psychologists, licensed clinical social workers. There is a dearth of them in cities around the country. And so, you know, specific to the Boston area, if you want to see if a parent so chooses that they want to see a Black male child psychiatrist, off the top of my head, I know five of us, including myself, for the city of Boston. Maybe there's someone else who's you know, not a part of the group and that I just don't know. But it is hard to find services. And so what we're seeing as a consequence of that actually is for those patients who come to our hospital in a psychiatric crisis, and let's say that they need an inpatient hospitalization, there's this concept called boarding or psychiatric boarding. And we have patients who are spending days and weeks in our emergency room on the general medical floors who are waiting for a psychiatric bed. And again, that's it. That's at the crisis level. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about this outpatient services, we ramped up, you know, the use of telehealth. And so for certain states like Massachusetts, Governor Baker's extended the provision to utilize telehealth services. And so that's definitely helped, but there's still communities that maybe don't have great access to Wi-Fi. And so it is challenging still, despite the use of teleservices.
Okay, so Dr. Makis, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because Dr. Simon does point out that telehealth has actually kind of undergone a total revolution due to this pandemic, and it's much more prevalent than it used to be, but also dependent on having really broadband access. So in places where that isn't reliable, and also there are many places in rural America where if you needed emergency care, for example, emergency psychiatric care, the local hospitals have either been consolidated or closed down, and you have to drive hours for help. I mean, there are a lot of places in the United States where it's just not easy to even get basic primary care. So what do you do in the case of a mental health emergency?
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think Dr. Simon is talking really about a couple of things. I think first is that before the pandemic, the population needed mental health care, and 0.17% was trained. And certainly if we look at trained professions of color, it's almost non-existent. Then we have this telehealth revolution, as you pointed, Meghna. But what we see is the digital divide. My patients in the community don't have access to it, not only for mental health care, but also for their education. And so what we see is that disparities become wider and wider and wider, and it's really hard to get access. And I think that's why I think a lot about to train individuals to give some of this mental health help. They're not so specialized as Dr. Simon and I, so that we can do something about that supply and demand gap. That's
Dr. Makis, it looks like your line is getting even less reliable right here from Boston. So the internet is definitely not a solution for everything. But we're getting a lot of feedback from listeners. JK is saying the pandemic already amplifies the depression and mental stress, but the previous ineptitude of the prior administration's handling of it further amplifies the frustration of people who are trying to survive. Sarah Barnard Conley says, I'm having terrifying nightmares that makes already troubling sleep near impossible. Isolation and loneliness kills learning the pandemic of loneliness isn't the only the result of COVID. Dr. Simon, we've just got about 30 seconds before the break. So let me ask you, have you seen sort of underlying mental health needs being further inflamed by the pandemic?
Yeah, definitely. So people who had, you know, mild anxiety, mild depression, certainly have had situations where they're definitely seeking out, you know, opportunity to try to engage in therapy and or, you know, the need of pharmacologic intervention. So it certainly is worsening folks that had, you know, subsettal conditions where they required mental health needs.
Right. Well, when we come back, we're going to start talking about solutions, both big and small. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour we're talking about the increased collective need for mental health services in the United States because of the pandemic. It has had a big impact on the mental health of many, many Americans. I'm joined today by Dr. Luana Makis and Dr. Kevin Simon as well, and we are solidly into the solutions part of today's exploration here. And in order to do that, I want to actually go back in time and see what we can learn from previous sort of mass disasters and specifically pandemics. So listen along with me as we hear from clinical psychologist Stephen Taylor. He's at the University of British Columbia. And back in 2019, or October specifically of 2019, he wrote a book called The Psychology of Pandemics, Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak of Infectious Disease. And this was October 2019. And it's a funny story because he had trouble getting it published, but fortunately he did, because just 4 months later, the next global pandemic became a reality.
All of the phenomena we're seeing today have been seen in past pandemics. In fact, the parallels outweigh the differences, not just in the 1918 one, but in other pandemics too. The rise of anticipatory anxiety before the actual spread of infection in communities, the rise of racism, blaming people, conspiracy theories. At the time, that was World War I, and the US and England were at war with Germany. In both of those countries, there were conspiracy theories that the influenza pandemic, or the virus, was actually caused by the Germans as a bioweapon. And in fact, there was a statement from a health official appearing in the New York Times in 1918 claiming that German agents in U-boats, that is submarines, were coming ashore in Manhattan in the dead of night and going into cinemas and public places and so forth and releasing the flu virus to contaminate people. There was also a rumor circulating at the time that the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, which in the US, which was formerly a German company, that they were putting the virus into the aspirin tablets. And that conspiracy theory got circulated so widely that the health authorities in the US had to go and officially test the tablets to reassure people that there was no virus in them. Of course, there wasn't.
The conspiracy theories today are just recycled conspiracy theories from past pandemics. They vary in details, but the themes are exactly the same. There was that, there was panic buying, there was stigma or fear and avoidance of healthcare workers, and there was the rise of anxiety about getting infected. And conversely, there was also this disregard for the whole thing, thinking the thing is exaggerated. The big difference is everything is faster and more of it. because we've got the 24/7 news cycle, social media, and so forth. But fundamentally, pretty much the same phenomena. I'm going to tell you something that no one believes when I tell them. No one ever believes this. People will bounce back. This is what happened in 1918. In Western countries, everyone was wearing a mask. We're all masked up. Then the pandemic ended around 1920. The Roaring Twenties hit in. And if you look at photographs of the Roaring Twenties, no one is wearing a mask. And everyone is out socializing and congregating. And in fact, we're starting to see this already. In Wuhan, when they were released from lockdown, there were photographs circulated in August of last year of parties. And there was one in particular that struck me. It was a pool party, a massive pool party where they had a band playing. And the photograph, there was thousands of people. They're on inflatable rubber toys and they're partying and dancing and no one is wearing a mask. Thousands of people. That is what's going to happen. But that said, there will be a proportion of people, and it's really hard to predict. It could be 10%, it could be a little higher, who will have lingering psychological problems. And I'm thinking depression for people who've lost loved ones or lost their businesses or homes or so forth, have had severe losses. Obsessive compulsive disorder for people who've had pre-existing obsessive compulsive tendencies and who've experienced the serious threat of infection. And post-traumatic stress disorder for people who've been traumatized during the pandemic, people who've got, for example, deathly ill and were frightened they were going to die. So yes, some people will have lingering psychological problems, but most people will bounce back to their surprise and delight. And I'm expecting that there will be a short-lived period of hyper-sociability, a kind of mini Roaring Twenties, as people just bounce back and say, oh, yay, this is over.
That's Stephen Taylor, clinical psychologist at the University of British Columbia and author of The Psychology of Pandemics, preparing for the next global outbreak of infectious disease. Dr. Kevin Simon, let me start with you. What did you think when you heard Stephen Taylor say most people are going to bounce back when this is over?
Yeah, so it was interesting listening to him. I think he is accurate in that most people do have a reserve of resilience. And so, throughout our life, most of us experience hard times and so, but won't have, a full major depressive episode or develop generalized anxiety or PTSD. So we do have quite an ability to adapt. And I think I'm even seeing it in my patients and parents who are certainly planning, when the vaccine is available for the general adults in the springtime, we're going to get it. When everyone gets it, we're going to go on trips. And so people are already planning what's going to happen when I get this vaccine. I do think where I put a little hesitation on what he said is the people who now have access to mental health services because of teleservices, it'll be very interesting to see what kind of policies happen post, quote unquote, post pandemic. Mm-hmm. Because once you actually provide people with safety nets, it's very hard to pull that back. And so it'll be interesting to see what insurers do, because now people are going to say, wait a minute, I was able to see Dr. Simon from my home. Why do I have to drive 2 hours to, come to Boston to see him? So I think depending on what policies kind of get implemented, we may see either a number of people being very frustrated that now they have to kind of adapt to things as usual, or again, those that are resilient and say, oh, you know what, I needed the services during 2020, 2021, but I don't need them anymore.
Interesting. Dr. Makis, what did you think about Dr. Simon's concern about perhaps a retraction of the slight expansion we've seen of access to mental health care? His concern that it could be pulled back after the pandemic has waned away.
I think that would be devastating. I think we certainly were able to increase access by having telehealth. And so I think for most people, they will need to rely on that. And I think Dr. Taylor was right that most people are resilient, but maybe 10% of the population won't be. And those individuals are certainly going to need the services that they currently have available now in long term.
You know, for a year now, we've been talking about how the pandemic has raised a mirror, right, on the truth about American life, both good and bad. And that, you know, what we see in the reflection of that mirror is also opportunities for change. And it seems so evidently true here with this discussion on mental health. And I'm wondering if you think that the Biden administration is taking enough advantage of this opportunity. I'm not sure they are. I mean, it just this week, just a couple of days ago, the Biden administration announced the addition of a mental health professional to the administration's COVID Health Equity Task Force. That's Octavio Martinez, executive director of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health at the University of Texas at Austin. So one person. The administration also points to the fact that they've asked for increased funding for expansion of mental health services. That's in their big $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. Of course, that's predicated on it passing Congress. But I'm not sure I see much more than that. So, Dr. Simon, I mean, do you think the Biden administration is taking advantage of this moment in the way that it ought to?
So I think they are attempting to. And so the challenge is mental health tends to take a backseat to a number of, you know, other concerns, even though it itself is required to have full health. I think there's historical context here. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008 was passed to, in theory, to make it, you know, to have parity in paying for mental health services versus physical medical services. Yet despite being passed in 2008, more than a decade later, we recognize that insurers are still finding loopholes as to make pay not equitable and to make access and services not as equitable. So I think there is some historical context to say that mental health will take, unfortunately, a backseat. I think the Biden administration, given we're in the first 100 days, has a unique opportunity to make sure that it's at the forefront. And generally, when folks have good mental health, their overall health will be better. So I would be hopeful that they don't squander the opportunity.
Well, you know, President Biden has said that his administration's on a war footing to fight the COVID pandemic. Interesting language, because it was after the Second World War in 1947 that President Harry Truman launched the National Institutes of Mental Health. I mean, Truman used the actual war to create what was then the largest expansion of mental health services in the United States. I mean, here's Truman in his 1947 State of the Union address.
Of all our national resources, none is of more basic value than the health of our people. Over a year ago, I presented to the Congress my views on a national health program. The Congress acted on several of the recommendations in this program: mental health, the health of mothers and children, and hospital construction. I urge this Congress to complete the work begun last year and to enact the most important recommendation of the program: to provide adequate medical care to all who need it, not as charity, but on the basis of payments made by the beneficiaries of the program.
It's President Harry Truman in his 1947 State of the Union address. Dr. Makis, do you think this is an opportunity for the kind of big thinking expansion that we saw, for example, in 1947?
Absolutely, Magna. I think the mental health reform needed to happen a long time ago. And I think Dr. Simon said it beautifully, that if you are healthy in terms of your emotional health, then you also have benefits in terms of your physical health. I see the Biden administration certainly attempting to look at this, but I think we need major policy changes to not only think about intervention, but also prevention. We need to think about what does it take to get ahead in this before we have such a high number of people needing help, and that can only be done at a policy level.
Okay, so then specifically, what policies would you like to see created or changed? I mean, give me an example of what you're talking about.
Certainly. I think one of the things that we need to think about is prevention through education, for example. So we know that as students go back to school, not only they will have emotional challenges adapting, so will their teachers. So how do we teach some basic skills of emotion regulation and mandate it in schools so that we are actually helping individuals learn? Kids can't learn if they are on fight or flight. And so could we have a mandate at a federal level that emotional health and especially emotion regulation is mandated as we integrate back in schools? That would be revolutionary.
Interesting. Dr. Simon, I mean, you're the pediatric and adolescent specialist. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I would agree with Dr. Marquise. In addition to that, funding for public mental health services, specifically for child and adolescents, young adults, tend to be underfunded. And so, you know, in the specific niche that I'm in with adolescents who, you know, have substance use challenges, there's a dearth of resources, dearth of treatment centers. So I think there's an opportunity there because the evidence shows they're underfunded and they're not where people need them to be. So I think there's an opportunity for the Biden administration to really push this to the forefront. And again, I have to just reiterate, you know, strong, good mental health undoubtedly makes your physical health better. So it'd be key to fund the services. And then also that funding would allow folks who want to go into the mental health services field, which classically is underpaid, know, okay, there's an opportunity here. I can make a livable wage here. So I think that would be a key factor for me.
So we just have less than two minutes left. And I want to close by asking the two of you, how have you been coping? Learn from your personal experiences, if I could. Dr. Marquise, how have you been coping over this past year?
One of the things that has helped me a lot is actually being of service to others. So as much as I can, I try to do things like this so that we can disseminate good information. And then the other things that I'm doing is the same things I'm recommending to my patients and colleagues. You know, focusing on my sleep and exercise and time with my family, really disconnecting and connecting with those that I love to stay as sane as we can during this challenging times.
Wow. And Dr. Simon, what have you been doing to try and stay mentally healthy?
Yeah. So, you know, I talk about this freely. So I have a therapist myself and we meet pretty regularly. Even the days that I don't think I'm going to have something to talk about, undoubtedly I have something to talk about. And then, from a home perspective, my wife and I routinely on Friday evenings have date night, even though we're in the same living room every Friday. We're intentional about that time. And then I have a daughter who, when I'm with her, I'm with her. So I've done a better job of, you know, turning my email off. And really being connected when I'm home. So those things have been very helpful for me.
Well, Dr. Kevin Simon is a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow at Boston's Children's Hospital and a clinical fellow in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School as well. Dr. Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Dr. Luana Makis, a associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, director of Community Psychiatry Pride at Massachusetts General Hospital and president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. It was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.